Wrong with all the shuffle, shuffle off the waffle.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is October 5th, 2016, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Shuffle Off to Buffalo to Talk Thrombolysis for Acute Pulmonary Embolism. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Essie Reed. Essie is one of the chief residents in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University of Buffalo. Welcome to the SGEM, Essie.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Milne.
Well, I really enjoy coming to these EM residency programs to talk evidence-based medicine, knowledge translation, and spreading the FOMED.
Thank you for spending your time in Buffalo this week.
This is your chance, though, Essie, to give a big shout-out to the program. What's the best part of living in Buffalo? And you can't say Niagara Falls.
Definitely the food.
Okay, the food. And I went to one of your restaurants last night, and it was fantastic. But what's the best part of the EM program in Buffalo?
Definitely all of the people.
Well, let's hear from the people then. All right, that's enough patting on the back, Essie. Let's start this episode of the SGEM with a case presentation.
So we have a 75-year-old female with a past medical history of hypertension and non-insulin-dependent diabetes who presents with chest pain. She describes the pain as sharp, stabbing, and exacerbated with deep inspiration. She reports associated shortness of breath. She denies syncope, nausea, and diaphoresis. The pain has been present for 1 week and is nearly constant. She reports that she traveled to Florida to visit her grandchildren 3 weeks ago. She has no fever, chills, cough, or sputum production. She is complaining of ongoing chest pain, 5 out of 10, increased to 7 out of 10 when asked to breathe deeply for the exam. On examination, she is hemodynamically stable, lungs are clear, and the heart is regular without murmurs. Skin is warm and dry. She is generally well appearing. EKG shows sinus rhythm with a rate of 80 beats per minute. The patient has negative serial troponins. Pain is unchanged after nitroglycerin, but improved with morphine. She eventually develops tachycardia to a heart rate of 125, but remains normotensive. A CTA is performed demonstrating a submassive PE in the right pulmonary artery. Evidence of right heart strain is noted as well, with RV to LV diameter ratio greater than 0.9 on CTA. Our PE team is paged and a bedside echo is performed. This confirms right ventricular dysfunction on a bedside echocardiogram.
Well, pulmonary embolisms can be a life-threatening condition. The 2015 CHEST guidelines recommend systematically administering thrombolytic therapy in patients with acute PE associated with hypotension, defined as systolic blood pressure less than 90, who do not have a high risk of bleeding.
Treating patients with full-dose systemic thrombolytics can reduce the risk of death, but also increases the risk of major bleeding, including hemorrhagic stroke. To mitigate the risk of bleeding while still maintaining efficacy, low-dose thrombolysis has been tried. Reviews of the literature suggest that this may be a reasonable strategy, especially in patients with a high risk of bleeding.
A new method being studied to treat submassive and massive PEs is ultrasound-facilitated catheter-directed thrombolysis, or CDT. A small randomized control trial of 59 patients demonstrated that compared to anticoagulation alone, ultrasound-facilitated CDT improved right ventricular function compared with anticoagulation alone, with no major bleeding observed.
However, the CHEST guidelines still suggest systemic thrombolytic therapy using a peripheral vein over CDT in patients with acute PE who are treated with thrombolytic agents. They do note that patients with a higher risk of bleeding and have access to CDT are likely to choose catheter-directed therapy over systemic thrombolytic therapy.
So, Essie, what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer today?
So today we're going to ask, is ultrasound-facilitated, catheter-directed, low-dose fibrinolysis safe and effective for patients with acute, massive, or submassive pulmonary embolism?
And what's the reference?
We are looking at an article from Dr. Piazza, a prospective, single-arm, multi-center trial of ultrasound-facilitated, catheter-directed, low-dose fibrinolysis for acute, massive, and submassive pulmonary embolism. Published in the JACC in 2015.
So now we're going to go through the PICO. What was the population in this study?
They included adult patients 18 years or older with a proximal PE, defined as a filling defect in at least one main or lobar pulmonary artery, with symptoms of less than 2 weeks, and an RV to LV diameter ratio of at least 0.9 on contrast-enhanced chest CT.
And so they had massive PE or submassive PE. Massive PE was defined as syncope, systemic arterial hypotension, cardiogenic shock, or resuscitative cardiac arrest.
Submassive PE was defined as normotensive patients with PE and evidence of RV dysfunction.
Now, there were a number of major exclusions, and I'll list them in the blog, but let's get to the intervention itself. What was the intervention they used in this study?
They used full-dose IV unfractionated heparin plus ultrasound-facilitated catheter-directed low-dose tPA.
And that low dose was 1 milligram per hour for 24 hours in a unilateral PE and 1 milligram per hour for 12 hours for bilateral PE through two devices. What did they compare it to?
Nothing. They didn't have a comparison group.
All right. And so how about their outcomes, their primary efficacy outcome?
Their primary outcome was a measurement in the change of the RV to LV diameter ratio from baseline on a contrast-enhanced chest CT that was performed at 48 hours following the procedure.
And their primary safety outcome?
They monitored for major bleeding within 72 hours as classified by the GUSTO bleeding criteria.
So here are the author's conclusions. Quote, ultrasound-facilitated, catheter-directed, low-dose fibrinolysis decreased RV dilation, reduced pulmonary hypertension, decreased anatomical thrombus burden, and minimized intracranial hemorrhage in patients with acute massive and submassive PE. End of quote. Now, Essie, we've got a quality checklist to go through for observational studies, and there's 11 questions. I'm going to run through those with you now. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, so the first question is, did the study address a clearly focused issue?
Yes, they did.
Did the authors use an appropriate method to answer their questions?
No.
Was the cohort recruited in an acceptable way?
Yes.
And in fact, I reached out to the lead author and emailed him, and he responded very quickly and confirmed that these were consecutive recruited patients. Question 4, was the exposure accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
Was the outcome accurately measured to minimize bias?
Yes.
Yeah, so they used the CT, RV, LV diameter ratio and the GUSTO bleed criteria. Question 6, have the authors identified all important confounding factors?
Unsure.
And was the follow-up of subjects complete enough?
I don't think so.
And how precise are the results?
We're unsure about this.
Do you believe the results?
Yes, I do.
And can the results be applied to the local population?
It depends on your local services. They had 22 sites, including urban, non-urban, teaching, and non-teaching hospitals.
And the last question, do the results of this study fit with other available evidence?
Yes, it does.
All right, so let's go through those key results. They had 150 patients with PE. 31 of them were massive PEs, and 119 were submassive. And the mean age was 59 years. What was the primary efficacy outcome?
So they measured a mean difference in the RV-LV diameter ratio that was decreased by 0.42 with a standard deviation of 0.36.
And how about their primary safety outcome?
They measured major bleeding within 30 days and had 15 out of 150 patients for a 10% major bleeding rate.
So they broke it down into severe and moderate bleeds. They had one severe bleed, and that gives you 0.7%, and it was a groin vascular access site hematoma with transient hypotension requiring vasopressive support. And then they had the 14 moderate bleeds to make the 15 in total, so that gives you 9.3%.
Of note, there were 4 deaths, 3 were documented in hospital, and 1 outpatient death within 30 days, but no documented intracranial hemorrhages.
So now, it's time to talk a little nerdy. Yes, one of my favorite sections. So we're going to go through a few points here in the nerdy section. The first one is conflicts of interest. Many authors in this trial declared conflicts of interest. This does not make the data wrong, but should make us more skeptical of the study and the interpretation.
The major limitation of the paper is that they had no comparison group. Without comparing it to anticoagulation alone, half-dose systemic fibrinolysis, or full-dose fibrinolysis, it is not possible to comment on the efficacy and safety of ultrasound-facilitated, catheter-directed, low-dose fibrinolysis in comparison to these other treatments.
The third point was the incomplete data. There was a significant number of patients who did not have their CT measurement at 48 hours, in fact, 23%. While they observed no difference in baseline data, primary outcome, or in-hospital mortality, it does weaken the results a bit.
Additionally, they were measuring surrogate markers. The primary outcome was measuring the RV to LV diameter ratio, and as a surrogate marker, what is ultimately needed are patient-oriented, clinically relevant endpoints.
So now we need to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So we generally agree that ultrasound-facilitated catheter-directed thrombolysis improved surrogate outcomes with no observed intracranial hemorrhages in patients with acute, massive, and submassive PE.
Essie, before we get to the bottom line, the case resolution, and clinical application, I have a surprise.
Okay.
You did the critical review of this paper first.
Yes, I did.
And then I added my expertise as an attending physician with EBM critical appraisal skills.
Yes, you did.
Well, I have taken it to another level by reaching out to a famous PE physician researcher named Dr. Jeff Klein. Jeff is the editor-in-chief of AEM, creator of the pulmonary embolism rule-out criteria, or PERC rule, and published extensively in the area of PE. So I asked him to review our critical appraisal and give us feedback.
Let's hear what he says.
Hey Ken, Jeff Klein here from Indianapolis. I'm commenting on your interpretation of the Piazza paper, and I think you've done a great job of interpreting the limited data that we have to the best ability possible. You know, it is difficult when we have such limited data, but I would add a nuance that I think that if you look at the world's literature, that systemic lytics is probably the right answer for patients that have no risk factors for intracranial hemorrhage, meaning age less than 65 with no other real significant risk factors, such as recent fall or remote prior stroke. The head bleed rate in that population is going to be about 1 in 200. In contrast, it's more like 3 in 100 for age over 65 for systemic lysis. So I think if I had a patient with some type of risk factor for intracranial hemorrhage, I would be more likely to advise catheter-directed lysis because we give such a lower dose of systemic or of fibrinolytic, which is going to lower the head bleed rate and may explain the fact that there is about a 0% head bleed rate in the world's literature for catheter-directed lysis for PE. But great job. As always, with many issues with pulmonary embolism, we have nothing definitive. There has to be maybes and contingencies, and what we need is more data. We think that this will get resolved with a large trial that's being submitted for NIH funding in October, being led by Aki Sista and Sureth Vendelith, who are interventional radiologists. There's a number of emergency physicians on the steering committee, and let's hope that gets funded and can give us some answers in the next 5 to 6 years to come.
Wasn't that awesome to have Dr. Jeff Klein be able to give his impression of our critical appraisal and add it to this episode? We also specifically asked him to help us with the SGEM bottom line and clinical application. So here we go. What was the bottom line from this study?
Ultrasound-facilitated catheter-directed thrombolysis is associated with a low intracranial hemorrhage rate in patients with acute massive or submassive pulmonary embolism, but it is difficult to comment on efficacy without a comparison group.
So how about a case resolution?
So, on our patient, anticoagulation was initiated and thrombolysis was discussed with the patient as an option. As she remained hemodynamically stable and age greater than 65 and diabetes placed her at an increased risk of bleeding, catheter-directed therapy is offered. She decided on CDT, and the treatment is successful without any major bleeding.
So how are you going to take this information from this study and apply it clinically?
So in certain centers and in certain PE patients with a high risk of bleeding, ultrasound-facilitated CDT may be as effective and may have a lower intracranial hemorrhage potential than full-dose systemic thrombolytics, but more data is needed. The existing evidence is still stronger for systemic thrombolytics over ultrasound-facilitated CDT for hypotensive PE patients.
So what are you going to tell the patient at the bedside?
You have a large blood clot in your lung. It is in the artery that travels from your heart to your lungs on the right side. This can be life-threatening and is currently putting a strain on your heart. This can be treated with a clot-busting medication. However, due to your age and diabetes, you are at a higher risk of bleeding from the clot-busting medication. One option is to place a special catheter that reaches all the way to the site of the clot. This catheter stays there for 24 hours and uses a lower dose of the clot-busting medicine. It also has an ultrasound device on the catheter that delivers high-frequency sound waves. The ultrasound waves are thought to help the clot-busting medicine work better. This special catheter is a new way to treat blood clots in the lung. There's not as much evidence for this option, but it does seem to work well and is associated with less bleeding in the brain.
And now, Essie, I brought a big surprise to you with Jeff Klein, but you have a big surprise for me.
So we've brought our local expert in catheter-directed thrombolysis to contribute to today's program. So this is our very special guest, Dr. Zlotnick, who's one of the UBMD interventional cardiologists who is also trained in catheter-directed thrombolysis and is here to give us feedback on our case and our paper.
Well, thank you for having me. My name is David Zlotnick. I'm one of the interventional cardiologists here at University of Buffalo and also the medical director of our pulmonary embolism response program here for the Gates Vascular Institute.
So if this patient was in the emergency department and we paged the pulmonary embolism response team, what would your first response be and what would your plan be for this patient?
So in a patient like this, 75 years old, with large thrombus burden, especially in the right main PA, and evidence of right ventricular strain both by CT and by echo, we would be mobilized and also offer reperfusion therapy, mostly with catheter-directed thrombolysis for a lot of the reasons that have already been stated. One, her age of 75 increases her risk for intracranial hemorrhage significantly with IV thrombolytic therapy, mostly based on the PIETHO trial, which looked at patients with submassive PE and showed about a 2% risk of intracranial hemorrhage. We would most likely offer this patient catheter-directed thrombolysis, especially as she's now tachycardic with RV strain. These are bad signs, things that we look at with the PESI score, as well as the European Society of Cardiology guidelines to really risk stratify submassive PE patients into intermediate high risk or intermediate low risk. With her tachycardia, and subsequently I would suspect that her cardiac biomarkers would be elevated, she would fall into an intermediate high risk category, in which case hemodynamic compromise is higher than what we would like to see, and therefore reperfusion therapy would be offered with catheter-directed thrombolysis, as was done in this case. In patients who have an absolute contraindication to any lytic therapy or even anticoagulation therapy, we do have the option of doing a catheter-directed thrombectomy with an aspiration catheter, which we also have as well. But those would really be reserved for the highest risk patients who cannot have anticoagulation of any sort.
And so we always like to give a bottom line. And so what did you think of our bottom line with regards to this case?
I think this is an extremely reasonable bottom line. The data for this therapy is sort of in its infancy. We do have randomized trials as far as the ULTIMA trial, which was a small trial, and then the prospective trial from the CL2, plus meta-analysis and lots of registry data. Hopefully with the trials that Dr. Klein mentioned, the PE-TRACK trial that's being led by the investigators at NYU, we'll have more data as far as patient-oriented outcomes, because what we're looking at not only is in-hospital mortality and in-hospital adverse events, but also what's going to happen long-term in these patients. In the massive PE patients, we're really looking at saving their life acutely. In the submassive PE patients, their in-hospital mortality is still pretty low. So what we're looking at is, are we going to improve their morbidity long-term? And what we're really looking at is, are we going to improve the rates of development of CTEP and right ventricular heart failure, which are very difficult to treat from a cardiac standpoint.
Thank you so much for coming today, Dr. Zlotnick.
It's time for the Keener contest, and last week's winner was Andrew Bond from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base Hospital. Andrew knew that Claude Beck is credited with the first successful clinical defibrillation in a human patient. What's the Keener contest question for this episode?
So your question is, it was reported in 1933 by Tillett and Garner that Lancefield Group A beta hemolytic streptococci were capable of producing a fibrinolytic substance. What is the name of that substance?
If you know the name of this fibrinolytic substance, then send your answer to thesjam@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, University of Buffalo, thank you very much for inviting me to give grand rounds. I'm going to be heading off to the ASAP meeting shortly. If you're going to be in Las Vegas for the Scientific Assembly, make sure you come up and say hello. But Essie, before we conclude, you know you have to give the SGEM tagline.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next time.